Hello, and welcome to episode 19 of the Vegan Business Tribe podcast with myself, David Pennell, co-founder of Vegan Business Tribe. Now, I'm actually going to cut my normal introduction short today. You'll probably be glad to hear, because if you've already looked at the episode length, you'll have seen that today's episode, it's quite a bit longer than usual. And that's because we're doing something a little different with this one. Today, I'm bringing you a recording of a live panel discussion that I hosted a couple of weeks ago with VegFest UK. And if you're a long-time listener, you'll know that Vegan Business Tribe have teamed up a number of times now with VegFest UK. And because these live-streamed sessions, they're usually about an hour long. So in the past, I've broken them over two separate podcast episodes of about 30 minutes each. However, when I listened back to the recording of one I'm going to share today, I just wanted to bring it to you in its entirety, in just one session, because what we're talking about in this panel, it is so important. In business, we talk mainly about success, and I'm as guilty as this as anybody is. But what about failure, debt, mental health pressures of being in business, or working when you've got a hidden disability, or, you know, dealing with major setbacks and changes? These are all also part of business, but we rarely talk about them. These are the taboos that nearly everyone has to face at some time or other, especially if you run your own business, but few people talk about or share their experiences. Which is why I was honoured to be joined in this session by three vegan business owners who have all faced some of these challenges and they've survived to tell the tale. And it includes the co-founder of hugely successful vegan frozen pizza company, One Planet Pizza, and that's Mike Hill. And he joined us to talk about his first vegan restaurant business, and that ended when the debt collectors started taking anything that wasn't bolted down. We're also joined by the founder of vegan men's grooming range, King's Grooming, and that's Blue O'Connor. And he was just on the verge of signing their biggest ever deal to supply Virgin Atlantic with duty-free when the pandemic hit. And so since then, he's been focused on a number of different projects, including his own men's mental health organisation, which was born from Blue's own struggles with his mental health. And finally, I'm also joined by my Vegan Business Tribe co-founder, Lisa Fox. And now Lisa talks about running two successful vegan businesses whilst also coming to terms with being diagnosed with a hidden disability. And she's looking to bust the myth so that you can't run a business if you are autistic. And as I always say, if you want to go beyond the podcast and connect with our community of like-minded vegan entrepreneurs, then after you finish listening, head over to veganbusinesstribe.com, which is where you can also find the video recording of this panel discussion if you prefer to watch instead of listen, as well as lots more great free content. Okay. As I said, I've not cut this session into two because there's just so much important information in this one. It does mean this episode is about twice as long as our standard ones, but to be honest, I could have easily spent an hour chatting with each guest individually. So let's head over to VegFest UK online for our live-streamed panel discussing the things we don't talk about in business. Mike is our first panelist, and Mike, we've had the pleasure of you talking and being part in one of our previous panels, and I think it's fair to say that with everything that's been going on in the world, business failure is actually a very timely topic, because many businesses have been forced to adapt to survive, but not every business has been able to do that. One Planet Pizza, though, I think you're actually really fortunate that you just launched your countrywide home delivery service when the pandemic hit.
Yeah, absolutely. And also very fortunate that we're not in food service at all, whereas, you know, we're very close to some other brands who are 95% in food service. And obviously, if you're in food service, then it's a totally different matter. Fortunately, we weren't in food service at all. Pretty much all our pizzas are sold through independent health stores who have done pretty well during this. But the ones that have stayed open, they've actually, I think, been busier, as well as, you know, online on Ocado. But as you mentioned, we'd also January, not knowing anything about COVID, just literally launched the OPP Direct, the D2C model. So it had been up and running for a couple of months, albeit very, very quietly, before everything took off in a negative sort of way in March and April.
Absolutely. And I think that was a brilliant, just a very fortunate bit of time.
More fortunate than brilliant, David.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mentioned in your introduction that people, they do look at One Planet Pizza and they hold yourself and Joe up as the embodiment of successful vegan entrepreneurs. But from my own experience, and I've been in this game for, quite a long time myself now, success is like an iceberg. People see business success and they think that it just happened overnight, especially with, some of the vegan companies at the moment. But they don't see the years that led to that success. Now, was this the same with yourself?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, One Planet Pizza was actually, I was just thinking about, is the fifth business that I've set up over the last 35 years. I mean, there's a lot of experience, a lot of trial and error, and a lot of failures that help get you to the point. And I think it's always, because obviously most people only ever see the social media, the press releases, and things that go out, and everyone thinks that all vegan businesses are growing massively and making big profits. And the reality is that it's still incredibly tough to get a business up and running in a sustainable way and bring it to profitability. It really is, and it's probably going to get tougher because, as we talked about before, we've got a lot of the big boys, the meat and dairy industry. Companies and pretty much all now are getting into our space, and they've got some massive advantages over us in terms of scalability, route to market, finance. We've a classic example is that we've been asked to, we're looking at expanding into Germany, and we've been asked to price match a frozen vegan pizza made by a company that's called Garden Gourmet, and it sounds like a nice small family-run vegan pizza business. Who makes it? Nestle.
And
they're asking us to match price against a Nestle company, which has probably been made, and a million pizzas are being made down in Italy in a massive factory. So it's getting more and more challenging, I think. Even though the market is growing, increasingly we're coming up against some very large and experienced businesses.
I think you're 100% right there, because a lot of these smaller plant-based brands, they are being bought up by Nestle and Unilever, and they've got all this experience behind them. They've got the money behind them.
Yeah.
But before we go into that, it was interesting what you said about the number of businesses you've had before One Planet Pizza, because even Richard Branson, he's had more businesses that have failed and are not here today than he's had successes. But I know we're specifically talking about one of our very early businesses, which was the Cotton Club, I believe. So just tell me a little bit about what this was.
Yeah, so the Cotton Club was a vegetarian vegan restaurant, which I opened back in 1986-87 in Norwich, fresh out of university. Myself and a friend, we were both vegan, which back then, there weren't many of us around. And we knew we couldn't do a vegan restaurant, so it was vegan and vegetarian, but it was also non-smoking and played live jazz. So you couldn't get much more niche for the mid-80s because people forget that in those days, people were still smoking in restaurants. I think they were still smoking in aeroplanes, in cinemas, all these places, which probably a lot of people listening to this have thought, my God, I didn't realize people could smoke in all these places. So to launch a no-smoking restaurant that was vegetarian and vegan at the time, when I think the amount of vegans was down at 0.01%, within the country, vegetarians, I think at the time, because we put together a business plan, were sitting at about 8-10% of the population. But people hadn't even heard of veganism back there. So it was definitely a jump in the, a leap of faith and a jump in the dark.
Absolutely. So I'm guessing with this 80s veggie jazz cafe restaurant with non-smoking as well, I'm guessing that was a huge hit and you just had people flocking in.
We did for the first night. But that's because the food was free and it was mostly friends and family. I think like a lot of businesses, we got a lot of publicity and it was fairly busy to start off with. But then we realized that a lot of the people who liked the jazz wanted to smoke. A lot of the vegetarians and vegans didn't like the jazz. So we had created something which was, you know, incredibly niche. And also we had, you know, overstretched ourselves. It became apparent quite quickly in terms of the size of the place that we'd taken on, because we'd taken on an old jeweler's, actually, in Norwich, beautiful building. But it was about 70 covers, which was just too large. And I think, you know, looking back now, we'd done an incredibly good job at raising some money, some personal savings, some investment from friends and family. We managed to, I remember, amazingly get a bank loan. God knows how, because, you know, we were relatively inexperienced and we put together the business plan ourselves. But Lloyds Bank, I remember our bank manager, you know, lending us £20,000, and me just being amazed that anyone would do that in such a risky venture. So we spent the money, I think, not particularly wisely. Some of the things that we spent it on, we could have done it, you know, a lot smaller and a lot more. This concept I talk about quite a lot, this MVP, this minimal viable product, we should have started a lot smaller and just tested it rather than putting all our money in and not keeping any cash, you know, for the first 3 months, really.
Absolutely. And I think in business, you just mentioned MVP there, you know, yeah, minimal viable product. Mm-hmm. And it's only important that you put money into something in business that you've already proven, that you're putting that money in to scale it up and make more of it. So you started out with this 20 grand bank loan. Yeah. How long did that last? How long did it take?
I think we'd spent pretty much all the money within the first three months. I think we were trying to do it all on about 50,000. In total, and probably, you know, half of that went straight away on the fit out and equipment, kitchen, and some pre-opening marketing. And so we only had, you know, 20,000 buffer, say, to get us over those first few months. And, you know, within 3 to 4 months, things started becoming incredibly, incredibly tight. We opened, I remember as well, in I think it was April, May, and it was fine. But during the summer, we didn't have any outdoor seating, and it started getting, you know, very quiet through those summer months. And then it started picking up again a little bit in October. But by then, I think it had become apparent that, you know, we had too many overheads. And, you know, we'd got a lot of things wrong. And as I said, it was just, it was either, you know, much too niche, well, definitely was much too niche, and it was definitely 20, 30 years ahead of its time, I think.
I think absolutely, yeah. So you could see what was happening. The writing was on the wall, as you say. And I know that the business did pretty much run out of money in about 6 months. But yeah, did you have the temptation just to try and keep it going, you know, to go out there and find more money or get into more debt?
Yeah, we did. But I think myself, and I did it with you know, a good friend, as I say, and business partner. And I think it just wore us down trying to operate. And I remember, you know, some specific things that happened. We were just trying to operate on so much by a day by day, hand by foot experience. We were literally, I remember there was a few evenings where we just hadn't brought the food in that was on the menu. And as an order came in, we would literally run out the back and pop round to the Tesco's and get, you know, get the chips or whatever. It was getting that bad. It really was that we didn't want to change the menu and had to rewrite it, but we couldn't afford to get the stock in even for that evening and for, you know, something that was perhaps unusual on the menu. So that we were sending people running out to get the food literally as the orders were coming in. And we were trying to keep going until Christmas because we knew that, you know, Christmas would be good. So we just about managed that. But before we started the Christmas menu, things started, you know, disappearing from the restaurant. And I guess that's when we knew, and the customers started. When I say disappearing, I don't just mean disappearing into thin air. Some of the creditors that we still owed money for were coming in and taking stuff out of the restaurant. And that's when it really started hitting home. Classic example was the piano. I turned up for one evening shift and the piano disappeared. And the
piano. That was the end of your jazz.
Yes, yeah, the live jazz anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. So, sorry, Mike, just jump in. I mean, these are absolutely amazing stories, but you can laugh about it a little bit now, you know, and we can talk about it. But at the time, what effect was that having on you of the business going through this and having to shut down? And I know especially that you were left with quite a lot of debt to carry as well.
Yeah. I mean, it is tough emotionally because we'd put about 6 to 8 months worth of planning. As I say, with bizarrely, I'd managed to, in those days, students actually got grants, you know, and could live reasonably well. And because I was living on a very much a whole food plant-based diet at university, I was literally buying sacks of rice, and it was very different. There wasn't any sausages, burgers and ice cream. So we were living on rice and lentils, making our own bread, you know, a lot of fruit and veg, and I actually managed to save several thousand pounds. So even though I was relatively young at the time, I had put in pretty much everything that I'd managed to save into this business. Plus there was one or two friends that had put in some money and the bank loan, you know, which was personally secured with myself and the other business partner. So I do remember even, you know, I love a challenge, and it's great, you know, being up against the wall and having to deliver on things under pressure. But I think it just got too much in the end. And it was, I think it's really important to know, you know, when you need to start thinking about the exit strategy, for want of a better word.
Absolutely. And I think a business failing, that is something that as business owners, we all really do fear that, because it seems like it's such a definite end to a journey. But as you are living proof, you know, often that failure can be the start of something else. So why do you think there is such a stigma around businesses failing? Do you think it's
I mean, people always say it's very much a UK thing. It's totally different in America, isn't it? That it's almost, something which is just accepted. And if you're successful first time round with your business, then now that is the exception. I think other countries, other cultures have a much better view. You try things out, and perhaps one in three, one in five will get through. And in the restaurant business, especially, it's a really high percentage that's going to get through the first 12 months. You know, it's up to 30, 40, 50% of restaurants fail in the first 12 months. So I just don't think we should be surprised that there are so much, failures, and perhaps failures aren't the, aren't the right word for it. I mean, we'll probably talk about how we managed a debt in a little while. But if you try something and it doesn't succeed, and you have to then change, adapt, and come back to it in a different way, as long as you haven't, left a trail of debt behind you and broken promises, then I don't think it should really be seen as a failure. Yeah, and I think there's a lot of people out there who will talk quite often about business ideas, but to the people that actually take that idea and give it a go are incredibly brave. They really are. So I think to talk about these people as being failures is absolutely wrong.
Absolutely. And I think one of the reasons we don't like to talk about it is because, as you just said, you know, people take it on personally. They see it as a personal failing, not just a business failing. But one thing, I just to wrap up, Mike, so we are doing quite short interviews on this.
Yeah.
But do you think that if you'd had all the experience that you've got now, that you've been able to make the Cotton Club work, you know, what advice would you go back and give to 21-year-old Mike if you were his business advisor?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the first thing was that we didn't have enough money. And we underestimated how much money that it takes to get particularly something like a restaurant up and running. Even if you're busy at the beginning, you're going to have quiet periods and you need a certain amount of cash to manage that cash burn over the first 12 months. And I think secondly, I would definitely have started off smaller with less overheads to trial it and make sure that we could make it work. We just went too big too quickly. This lovely venue came up and it just really fitted the whole concept of the Cotton Club because it was quite an old building. And so we ended up, as I say, with a 70 plus cover restaurant, one of the larger restaurants in Norwich, for something that should have really been probably a quarter or a third of the size. So I think that's the two key messages. And I remember I then went on to become a salaried, for the next 15, 20 years, I actually then went and worked for other organizations. But I always knew that I would come back to running my own business. And once I did, then fairly quickly, I set up and ran, two or three different businesses, two of which I still own and one of which I've sold. And I still think back to what happened when I was 21, 22 and the lessons that I learned from that, definitely.
Absolutely. And that's amazing to hear, Mike. And I think especially if someone's going through a similar thing at the moment, they'll listen to you say that and they'll realize, as I say quite often, when businesses fail, it can be the start of a journey. Now, Mike, just before I move on to Blue as our next interviewee, if people want to try One Planet Pizza, where can they go to find out?
Yeah, the website. I mean, if you want to buy one from us, then you come to our website. We've got OPP Direct, and you can order 4 or 5 packs. We'll get them to you within a few days. Please, it's really important, I think, to keep supporting our independent health stores and whole stores, which are around the country. That's always been our solid base. So we're in about 400, 450 of them across the UK. We've got a locator map on the website. And finally, we're on Ocado. We're in Whole Foods down in London. We're on the Vegan Kind, which a lot of people listening probably use. So it's pretty easy to get a One Planet Pizza these days.
That's brilliant to hear, Mike. And thank you so much for that. And one day we'll maybe have a longer conversation about the Cotton Club. So that's brilliant. So next, we're going to follow hot on the heels that with our second guest, Blue O'Connor. And as I mentioned in the introduction, people may know Blue as the founder of vegan aftershave company King's Grooming, or for the work that he's done with numerous good causes, not just in mental health, but as you've mentioned as well. Now, Blue, before you got into all this, though, you actually started out on a very different career path as an aerospace engineer, I understand.
Yeah, that's right. Before I kick into that story, I just want to say I've been getting Mike's pizza from a Whole Foods shop in Bristol, and I agree with him that there's these big commercial entities moving into the vegan space. I won't mention any names, but if you can make that choice and go, right, I'm going to support that independent pizza that's vegan though, that ethics truly align as a global entity and organization, then yeah, go for someone like One Planet Pizza, because the pizzas are banging as well.
And I couldn't agree with you more on that. So, Blue, anyway, just to drag you back to your own story then, just tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, I'll try and keep it short. So I finished my A-levels and went straight into a aerospace engineering apprenticeship for an organization called Airbus. I worked in that industry, gained my apprenticeship, gained my degree, did that for nearly a decade. I think right from the off, I knew it wasn't really for me. It was a very formal setting. It was very constrained. There wasn't that much creativity. It's a very masculine, macho dominated industry, quite cutthroat, quite ruthless. Sometimes we were working on military planes and I refused to work on them. So I had quite strong ethics at sort of the age of 17, 18. So, but the problem was, is I just didn't listen to that intuition. I didn't listen to that inner voice. I wasn't that self-aware as a youngster or a young adult. And then as I continually buried that voice and carried on the job, I climbed the career ladder, very successful, ended up working for them on global projects in Europe, in the States, all around the world, flying business class, anything you'd think which is great, the corporate dream, as it was. But I was heavily depressed, not just because of the job. There were some genetic predispositions as well, but the job was such a major factor that I remember explicitly driving home from work. It was the day before my 26th birthday, and I had a panic attack driving home in the car, and I thought, because I'd never heard of that word before. I didn't know what depression was. I didn't know what anxiety was. I didn't have the emotional vocabulary or emotional intelligence. I thought I was dying. I thought it was a heart attack. And that experience led me to eventually quit my job. And I traveled and backpacked around the world for 2 years. And that moment I left was slowly and surely these layers started peeling back, and I started to question, right, what had I been taught? What have I learned? What am I doing that I don't really want to do because they've just been passed down to me as a story or a you must do this? And that's when I started challenging things like, why do I eat meat? Why do I work in a corporate job? And I started stacking up all these different they were there already, but peeling back the onion layers, I found out, right, this is my core. These are my beliefs. These are my ethics. These are my values. And this is what I want to do. And I came back to Bristol and I said, look, I've got to change my career. I want to move into the social enterprise and third sector and youth mentor and work in mental health, because I was lucky. I could quit my job. Financially, I was secure to an extent. All those people that aren't, that have to continue in these jobs they don't like, that don't get a break for their mental health, I've got to do something. And then I was getting out of the shower one day and I went to put on an aftershave, and I was thinking, I don't think this aftershave is cruelty-free or vegan. Like, where can I get one? And I remember the weekend, I must have spent about 20 hours researching, going, right, is there a male brand that does what I want? And I couldn't find it. And I got really excited and I thought, like, this could work. Like, I need to take this somewhere for validation. And I got funding from the School for Social Entrepreneurs. I got a couple of grants, a business program. I crowdfunded to release the product on a pre-order basis. So I knew that the market was there before putting in any money. Like Mike said, minimal viable product. And we launched with one fragrance. And it's been a roller coaster since then. I won't tell you where we are right now. I'll wait till that question comes up. But
your story there is really interesting, Blue, because I think with mental health struggles, so often people wait until they have a physical symptom, you know, to that mental health just bubbles over to actually affect you physically. And if we think that 20% of us will have to face a mental health struggle, you know, especially in the workplace, I often wonder why we don't talk more about this as business owners, because that comparison is always made between physical and mental illness. So if you went out and you'd broken your arm, for instance, people would accept that you needed to do something about that. But if you're struggling with your mood or your thoughts, then most people, we're just not open with that. You know, we don't want to talk about it. But if everybody struggles, what's actually stopping us from being more open about it?
Yeah, I think the world's in a lot better place than what it was when I went through my issues, which was probably 6-7 years. So it's come on astronomical since then, but we've got a hell of a lot of way to go. I think the subject in some circles is still highly taboo. I think the people don't want to show their vulnerability. There's a lot of shame around mental health issues. They're only going to get bigger, especially as we go through things like a pandemic and we go through financial crisis and we go through more challenges pushed upon us by climate change. Like this model of biopsychosocial that all congregate to mental health issues is just getting fuller and fuller. Our stress levels are going higher. Our time is getting lower. It's just a melting pot for people that probably traditionally would have never suffered from mental health issues. I think we're seeing those that maybe a decade, 20 years ago would have no issues. Now the hospitals are at max. The helplines are at max. We're seeing lots of people through the door at our talk club, social enterprise, and people you just wouldn't expect. It can happen to anyone.
Absolutely. Do you think some of that is tied in? So especially if we're talking about business owners as well, do you think some of that is just tied in of what people's view of what success is, you know, what a successful business person looks like? Do you know that they're trying to play that role perhaps so that they don't want to be showing, they don't want to be exposing themselves?
Yeah. You've got to think. I think it's slightly different in our industry, in the vegan industry, but it's a competitive market, isn't it? You show one element of weakness and you've allowed your competitor to exploit that. You show that vulnerability, you show that one ounce of weakness. Who knows how it's going to be exploited? I think that's why people are a bit more nervous about showing it in the business and corporate world. You don't know how it's going to be taken. We have these illusionary faces that we present, But behind that face, we've all got shadows and we've all got insecurities and we've all got other layers to us that we just don't bring to business. And I think, again, that's becoming more of the norm, but we are 1 yard to a marathon sprint on progress, really.
Yeah, absolutely. But I don't think I've known a business owner, and I've owned many, you know, businesses myself over years, but I don't think I've known any business owner who hasn't faced some mental health struggles at some point in their career, usually quite regularly as well. So I think the more we can talk about this and the more we can put our hands up and say, yes, you know, I've been through this, you know, Tim, who introduced us, he's been through this, Mike's been through this, you've been through this, the more we can see it as the norm, the better it is. You just mentioned Talk Club there again, though. And just to introduce what Talk Club is, this is something that you started alongside King's Grooming, and it allows men to set up their own local support groups just to talk to each other about how they're feeling. So you set this up as a men's group. So do you think it is harder for men, especially, to own up about their mental health?
Yeah, again, I think even in that subset of the world, mental health and the communication of it is even more taboo in male circles, especially if you look at certain demographics, especially working class, black and minority ethnic groups. These conversations are even more taboo. So it was my aim with a couple of friends to take these clubs to places where these conversations aren't happening, and being a catalyst for, you can have these conversations, come and join a club. You don't have to say anything. You can sit back and just witness what's going on and feel comfort that some of the emotions that you're feeling are shared by a whole spectrum of men. We get men that come along to one session and that's enough for them and they leave. We get men that drive 2 hours to come to a session. It's unbelievable. I've sat next to business owners in those sessions, and they are up against it, and what they bring to the group, they won't share with their family, they won't share with their business partner, they won't share with their friends, because they feel so much pressure, so much shame. And like you said, business owners are under extreme pressure. And there is a strong correlation, if you look at the research, between entrepreneurs and mental health issues. And there's an argument of what came first. Is it the mental health that drives us into entrepreneurship for the freedom, for the chance to map our own destiny? Or is it the stress of running a business and the financial strain and the responsibility that drives the mental health? I think it's a melting pot of both, but it's a very interesting subject to explore.
I agree. I think that's a really good observation, Blue. One thing I really picked up on when I was reading first about Talk Club and looking through your website is your own research stats say that the men who have attended a Talk Club rated their experience on average a 9 out of 10. So, you know, this is obvious that once someone actually starts talking about their mental health and you know, and starts normalizing it, it becomes a really positive experience.
Yeah, it's a really simple framework. So we have 4 questions, 2 hours. How do you feel out of 10 at the start? What do you feel grateful for this week? What are you going to do for your mental health this week? And how do you feel out of 10 now? And I would say, yeah, well, the stats, 90% of the time, people come out of that session feeling better. It's not rocket science. It's just a community that's supportive, that people can come and share, not feel judged, and almost leave that in the room and go back to their lives, because no one in that room knows them particularly well. So there's that freedom as well, freedom of expression, freedom of safety. And the people that run them have training. So if anything comes up that's too much, we can deal with that as well. And it's a magical thing, really. I never thought it would yield so much help for men. So we're just trying to grow it as much as we can now.
And that's a brilliant thing to hear. And I think that we can't completely ignore what is happening in the world at the moment. You know, the extra impact that coronavirus has had, not just on us as individuals, but our businesses as well. And for yourself, I know that the pandemic hit at quite an interesting time for Kings, didn't it?
Yeah. How do I explain this one? So for the past 2 years, I've been working, try not to swear, very hard on building this brand, building this product alongside various other commitments. Got 2 young children now, the social enterprise, the mentoring, and part-time job as well. And it was like, right, we're going to get to this point where we're investment ready. We've proven the model. We've got an MVP. I've put in what I can risk-wise. We've got a startup loan. Like, this is it. We're going to make it. We just got HMRC seed enterprise investment scheme tax relief granted. So that meant that investors could offset the risk slightly. I'd warmed up investors for the past 2 years, got a few verbal yeses, and it was going to be about 150K round. And the week, I think it was about the week or 2 weeks before that was all going to be set off, Corona started becoming a real threat in the UK. We were also due to pitch to Virgin Atlantic for a duty-free contract. So that would have been the sort of, right, I can, this is it, this is real, I'm on this full time. But unfortunately, they grounded their aircraft, and I think something like 90% of their staff were put on furlough. And it was sort of a sand dripping through my hands moment. It was like, I can't, what do I grab onto? And I just thought, I've worked my ass off. Like, physically and mentally, I am exhausted. I am broken. I think the stress that I put myself under, I only understood when I took my foot off the gas. Because after I had a bit of a moan and a cry for a couple of days, I just thought, right, I've got to take a break. Like, I'm not clenching onto this. I've got to let go. We were having our second boy in July. So I just thought, I need to recoup before this happens. So decided to just put all my efforts into Talk Club, get some more clubs set up. We managed to get a charity single out and an alcohol-free beer as well, which was great. So it was just about going, my passion, yes, I love my brand, but the overarching passion is ethics and mental health. That doesn't have to change. It might be a different vehicle. So I moved from Kings to Talk Club, but I can still push that energy, that passion, and feel like I'm making a real difference just in a different car. And that's been tough.
It is, but I think that's a really important part just to finish on there is, you know, so many people, when change happens in life, they think that it is an end, and it's pretty much what we said with Mike earlier. But you can change what you're doing to get the same outcome, you know, just because I love it. You just, you said it was almost like a car. You can get out of one car and get into another car, but keep doing that journey. And I think that's amazing what you've been able to do over this time too.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So thank you very much, Blue. We could have probably very easily have spoken for a full hour on everything that you've been doing during the lockdown with your charity singles and your alcohol-free beer. And I'm sure we can talk about a little bit more about that when we get to the end. But I just want to wish you all the best of luck for Kings and whatever projects you decide to do next. But if people want to find out more about Kings and Talk Club and what you're doing, where do they go?
Yeah, it's kings-grooming.com for Kings, and it's wetalkclub.com if you want to come and join an online Talk Club session or a physical group or a run or a cycle. Just come find us.
That's brilliant. So thank you so much for that, Blue.
Thanks, David.
Okay, so we could have really done with an hour for everyone. We're getting such good stories out today. So maybe we will do a longer version of this one day. But our final guest today on today's panel is Lisa Fox, co-founder of both Promote Vegan, which is an agency helping brands and food manufacturers better connect with the vegan marketplace, and Vegan Business Tribe, which is an online community of over 1,000 vegan businesses. And as I said at the start, just to avoid any allegations of nepotism here, Lisa is actually my partner in both business and life. But Lisa, you actually took quite a big decision last year to go public when you got your diagnosis of autism. Now, we've just spoken with Blue about why people don't like to disclose their struggles. So what made you feel that you had to share that you'd been diagnosed with autism?
I did, but it wasn't an overnight thing with regards to one day I thought it was non-autistic, and then the next day it was suddenly a big thing. It, you know, it takes, as anyone who's gone through a diagnosis will know, it takes a long time, and especially with lockdown and things. So I'd been questioning myself for quite a while about if it came to the point where I did get a diagnosis of autism, what was I going to do with that? And so I had to question myself ethically about that as well, because I know there's a lot of stigma and assumptions about autism. And there's a lot of misconceptions and misrepresentations, especially in the media. And I think a lot of people don't really understand that it's a neurological difference and that we just process things differently. And it can often be comorbid with other things like learning difficulties and personality disorders, you know, just like with any other thing. But it's not the same thing. I was aware that a lot of reports of crimes, if it involved a person with autism, they always focused in on the autism. That was always in the headline, and not the comorbid conditions and the interconnected nature of the problems that they have kind of all working together to produce the end result. And so it's meant that I think because of all these things, many people think that all autistic people can't speak or make overblown gestures constantly, or have like way below average IQ, or have way above average IQ, or have some insane special talent, or are unemployable, or are violent, or just can't function properly on a daily basis, and definitely can't run a business. And people don't really understand that it's a spectrum and it affects everyone differently. And a spectrum doesn't mean kind of low functioning to high functioning. It's more like a percussion board where, you know, you can kind of push different buttons and I'm just in this corner, but some people are over here and this one as well. And so it's kind of all over the place. And I really questioned myself because I thought if I feel like I couldn't or shouldn't go public with it, then I kind of knew that I needed to go public, or it meant that I was accepting that it's actually something that I should be ashamed of. And I just thought, if I'm not part of the solution, then I'm actually part of the problem. And I know I was really inspired by Blue's own personal journey and what he's been doing with Talk Club and how he's been trying to help. So I had to ask that question of myself, that if I stay quiet about my own struggles, then who am I actually helping? And the answer is nobody. So being open about your struggles just helps to educate other people and help other people to be their authentic selves as well. I know when I came out, a few people said how brave it was of me to do that. And that word just actually makes me quite sad, because it shouldn't be that way. You shouldn't need to be brave to just be honest.
Absolutely. And I think that ties in with Blue's story really well. And it is true. You know, you mentioned there that if you didn't talk about this, you would be part of the problem. But many people who have autism and hidden disabilities, they don't work, or at least they don't work full time. You know, a few of them actually run their own business. But you are the co-founder of two vegan businesses at the moment. But so were you worried, you know, that going public that you are autistic might affect those businesses and just people's view of what your ability is?
Yes, I was terrified, absolutely terrified, both personally and professionally. And that's exactly why I felt like I needed to be out and proud about it. If I'm terrified, then there's an issue there, and there's a social stigma there, as well as a professional stigma. And again, I'd be part of the problem. And it's just that acceptance of I can be autistic and be amazing at what I do. And again, that helps educate non-autistic people about autism, but it also helps other autistic people to know that they can achieve what many other people probably tell them that they can't, or if they're listening to the media or whatever, then they're thinking they can't do certain things. You know, I feel in some ways quite lucky that I found out later in life, because it's potentially an issue that earlier diagnosis might have made me feel quite limited. And it becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, in that if other people are telling me, you know, when I was young, if I'd have been diagnosed when I was 5, and I've spent my whole life with people telling me that I'm autistic, and so I'm giving me lots of help, then I might have just thought that I just can't do things.
Yeah.
So it's just really important to understand your own strengths and weaknesses and work with those rather than against them. Rather than kind of trying to fit my square peg into other people's one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that one of the big reasons that you wanted to be open about your diagnosis, it was not just to challenge that stigma, but it was this, what you said about pretending. You know, I think you've spent most of your career and your life pretending not to be autistic. So do you think the big problem in business especially, and this does tie into what I was talking to Blue about, but there's a big problem with us comparing ourselves to other business owners, other people's view of what success is, and just not being honest and authentic?
Hexagonal. Yes, again, I think it's kind of this fear of failure as well, that it's and it's not just in terms of other people's definitions of failure, it's whether that's physical things or monetary, it's in terms of failure as a person, that people will think badly of us, or people will want to work with us or be a friend or be in a relationship with us. And we're constantly being fed these images of supposed perfection and success and what we're meant to be as people. And the thing is that it's mostly faked. You know, that person's photoshopped, that car's borrowed, that apartments are set, you know, they have a beautiful home, but they don't get to spend any time in it. You know, their videos might promote how successful they are and then utterly omit them kind of crying in the bathroom three nights a week. And so if you keep comparing yourself to other people, then it's really an unfair comparison, because you've got no idea what other people's struggles are either. And in reality, I've found that the more authentic you are and the more real you are, then the more people actually warm to you and accept you, and the more you can encourage people to adjust their own perceptions of success and norms. You know, what's helped me personally is doing something I'm really passionate about. So, you know, Vegan Business Tribe is my passion. But I can still get completely and utterly terrified at the responsibility of running my own business. But it does get better and less terrifying the longer I'm doing it. And I'm sure that's the same for other people too. But there are, I think Blue touched on it as well, there are real benefits to running your own business as well if you're autistic, because, you know, in the past when I was an employee, I was expected to do like a lot of social routines with colleagues and clients, and it was really draining for me. So when, at least when you have your own business, you can actually set your own boundaries.
Yeah, so I know from, you know, having worked with you now full time, you know, those sort of boundaries is, for instance, you're not always great on the telephone, so you can just not do work on the telephone. You can not give out a phone number. You don't have to be in an open plan office. So I'm guessing that by actually being authentic to your authentic to yourself, you've literally had to spend the time of your life pretending to be someone that you were not. But do you think at some point that we all just realise that everyone else is just pretending?
Please. Well, I spent a whole lifetime thinking that everyone was pretending and trying as hard as I was until I realised it was just me on a personal level. But with regards to professionally, then after speaking to so many kind of business owners on a one-to-one basis, I think that everyone puts on a professional face to one extent or another. And it's that nobody really feels able to actually share their struggles, because they feel it will kind of affect other people's perception of their professional abilities, and that leads to a serious lack of support. And the thing is, in this sector, in the vegan business sector, we all actually want to help each other, and we can't do that and support each other authentically if we aren't being human. And part of that is we really need to be honest with ourselves and each other. Yeah. Or we actually remove the ability to support each other
as well. Absolutely. And I think you can get to the point where you realize that nobody's really being human, you know, nobody's really being their authentic self. And that really does remove that ability to support, just as you were saying. And we talk about authenticity a lot in business, and especially on social media and in building this relationship with your audience. Authenticity has become a bit of a buzzword. But what's the reaction been of people, you know, since that you decided to actually be your authentic self and come out with your autism diagnosis? Do you feel under less pressure of having?
Yes, that's the short answer. I suppose people that I've known for a really long time, there hasn't been much reaction other than a bit of surprise, and then that's it. To them, I'm still just kind of odd, weird, shy Lisa. And I think it's probably really hard to adjust and understand someone's struggle when they've been pretending and masking as well as they can for their whole life. And the people who I haven't known as long, I've generally had a really positive response. And it's been nice that like the public Facebook post that I did initially actually helped to empower some other people. There were some people that I don't even know. I think some of my friends kind of shared the Facebook post, and it got around a little bit, and some people I didn't even know got in touch and just said how it helped them and empowered them. I found vegans especially supportive, but there's no surprise there. I think I'm beginning to put myself under less pressure, but that's definitely a journey for me to take, and I'm kind of still at the
done that. Yeah, and I think that's really important what you just touched on there at the end about how when you come out with something like this, and I know when we put a post out on Facebook about your autism and the struggles that you do face on a daily basis, we got so many messages of people coming back and saying, actually, have you got 10 minutes to chat with us? You know, this is something I feel that I've been going through as well. So it really did put the story out there. And again, it came back to normalizing. And I think that's the theme that's coming out of today's session, is normalizing these things that we don't talk about.
Start of that. Yeah, I think, again, as you all said, the more that you actually speak about this, then the more normalized it becomes. And the more, I'll say, courage it gives other people to be open about their own struggles. And again, that comes back to what I said at the beginning. Courage is a really bad word, because you shouldn't need to be courageous to speak about your struggles. You shouldn't need to be courageous to speak about your authentic self. So speaking out about it, the more of us that do it, then the better it's
business. Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're trying to do a little bit of that at Vegan Business Tribe, aren't we? You know, the face that we put out there, both you and myself, you know, it is quite choreographed, you know, things are quite often scripted and things like that. But we have been trying to now, you know, bring in some of the authentic Lisa and David and you know, just maybe not cut off the videos at the end so you can see how we really are and things like that. And that's gone down really well. So just as a closing point, though, if someone is living and working in a similar situation, either what is described as a hidden disability like autism, as you have, or they just feel trapped having to pretend to be something that they're not in business, what advice would you give to them?
I think it's a case of, we're all so quick to be kind of kind and compassionate to other people, but we've really got to be kind and compassionate towards ourselves. And don't expect other people to be compassionate about what you're actually experiencing, what you're experiencing at the time, if you're not being completely honest with them about your struggle. You'll often find a better and kinder response than you're expecting if you're being honest. If you try and be honest and they still don't understand, use some resources, ask if they'd be willing to read a book or watch a YouTube video, and find other people who are actually experiencing similar things. Do look for support. There's so many people out there who are struggling the same way that you are, no matter what your struggle is. One of the main things is to actually work out your strengths and your passions and work with those, work towards them, you know, stop working against them.
Absolutely. And I think people's reactions, they'll always be far more positive and supportive than that they think you will be, you know, just from what we've got back from your own announcements and that. But tying into what Blue was saying and what Mike was saying, when you actually go out and you are brave, you know, and it's a term we don't like, but when you actually go out there and you are honest and you are authentic, people's reactions are always far better than you think they're going to be. It's never as bad as you're fearing, is it?
No. An optimistic answer. No.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. So, thank you, Lisa. So, but if people have a vegan business and want to know more about Vegan Business Tribe, where do they go?
So just come to the website. So that's veganbusinesstribe.com. We've got podcasts on all major platforms as well. And I run our Instagram. Just search for vegan.
Go to find out. That is absolutely brilliant. And thank you so much, Lisa. Now, I think you will all agree that that was three conversations that we don't usually have as business owners. So I'm going to just bring everyone back into a group conversation, if we can get everyone back on screen again, just to have a conversation about what we've just heard. And Mike, I want to come to you first. Can I just ask you what resonated the most with the conversations that I've just had with Blue and Lisa? Mm-hmm. Blue and Lisa, you know, feel free to jump in with your own comments.
I guess the sort of the themes that follow through all our experiences is about being authentic, isn't it? And authenticity. And I think if people, I remember when you know, managing the debts that had built up, we owed quite a lot of money. And it's so easy when things go wrong to ignore them and put them to the back of your mind and not address them. But nearly pretty much every problem in life is much better once you address it, and it's never as bad as you think it's going to be. So when we contacted the four or five companies that we owed money to and explained the situation, it was actually probably one of the best business experience negotiating with them and setting up the debts and repaying them over a period of 3 years. I was amazed what we could actually achieve and what they were happy to accept. Yeah. But if we had just left that and it ended up going through the courts, it would have increased the cost, we would have ended up going formally bankrupt. And so, you know, that was actually surprisingly a positive experience and something that really stood me in good stead dealing with debt in that sort of open way.
Absolutely. Blue, is this something that you agree with as well? You know, especially picking up what Lisa was just speaking about this pressure of having to mask in business to present this image of a successful and competent business owner. You know, can you present just as strong an image if you are more honest and authentic with your audience?
Yeah, that's a tricky question. I think we'd all like to be as honest and upfront and show our real faces at all times. But in reality, that's not always the case, is it? I think we are in a special industry where that's a lot easier and that there's a better community. The networks are stronger. They're less superficial. This conversation, for an example, and speaking to people like Mike and Lisa and yourself, that's a prime example. I just think it's human nature, isn't it? The more of us that do it, the more people that will follow, feel empowered, feel safe, and it's normal, isn't it? Like at the end of the day, we're all humans. We experience a range of emotions and a range of challenges. There's not that much difference between us.
Anything to add to that, Lisa?
No.
I tell you what, I love that result because, you know, this is something that we actually try to avoid when we put it out there, but that is an extraordinarily artistic and honest answer.
But the thing is, this is the great thing about actually being diagnosed now, that, you know, a year ago I would have felt really pressured and I would have panicked and then, oh no, it's come to me, and then trying to think of something to say and stumbling over myself, whereas now I'm okay to say no. Like, what they just said is really great. I can't really add to that.
Fantastic. But I mean, I'm just going to pick up on one point that you did say, you know, in when you spoke back to us, Lisa. You talked about the idea of being terrified that you're actually running your own business instead of being employed. So where do you think that comes from? Because we know the reality is if a business fails, then you can always just go find a job, you know, or you can set up another one. So coming back to this point about the stigma of failing, where do you think that comes from?
I think it's not actually about other people. It's about me and feeling safe. And for some reason, you know, I was employed for a long time, rather than actually running my own business. You know, for the first long time in my career, I was actually employed. So, I was used to that being the safest route. And I know you, David, you kind of say to me, yeah, but if you actually run your own business, you're in control and you can see actually things that are going to happen. You can put things in place. You can try and avoid certain things. Whereas if you're an employee, you often have no idea what's actually going on in the business. Mm. And, you know, if it goes under, then you don't even see it coming. You know, you're working there one day, the next day the doors are closed. But it's really hard, I suppose, for a lot of people. I think when you've been used to being employed for a long time, you see that paycheck coming in. You don't have to worry about certain parts of the business. You have your targets, you hit them, you know, you're fine. You just go home, you forget about it for the weekend. Mm. So it's terrifying, I think, actually knowing that I'm in charge. If something goes wrong, then I messed up and maybe I could have done something about that. So it's being able to adopt a different mindset that takes quite some time, I think, to adjust to.
Absolutely. And Mike, I just want to bring you in on that comment, because it's something that Blue talked about as well. You know, this whole idea of the mindset of a business owner, is it the fact that, you know, because somebody is more open to depression or more open to mental health problems, that they go and set up their own business? Is this something that you've seen as well, that just far more people who own their own businesses, they are just very open to mental health struggles?
Yeah, I don't know. It's difficult to say which one follows which, isn't it? Because it could be the sort of person that sets up a business that's more open to that, or it could be that if you set up your own business, you get more of it because of the strains and stresses. I mean, I personally, I think anyone who sets up their own business, and I know we've got to be careful about using that word, it is an incredibly brave thing to do, because it's definitely not the norm in our society and culture. I think there are other, and I'm not necessarily meaning America, but there's probably a lot of countries where that are perhaps, you know, less developed, in inverted commas, where there's a lot more small businesses around, and they're the biggest part of the economy. And, you know, 50% of people may be running their own business in some sort of way, whereas, you know, the figures in this country must be a lot smaller. So I don't know, Dale. I think one interesting thing, I think, if you may have heard of this, the imposter syndrome, I think that's one of the biggest challenges to people running their own businesses. There's these conversations that are going on in your head all the time, and there's almost a built-in part of us which always says, well, you're actually not very good at this, and, you know, why are you doing it? And you're not really a business person, you're just playing at being the business person. Uh-huh. And I think that's one thing to really be, but if you're aware of that, you know, that there is that always in most people, this part of you which is constantly saying, you know, you're not worthy of this, and you call you and you don't really know what you're doing. And just being aware of that, and the fact that that's going to continuously come up in your mind, I think is a really, you know, powerful thing to be aware of.
I think so. So how can we fix this then? You know, so the whole theme today is the things that we don't talk about in business. Do you think that business would be all the better if we did start talking more about these things?
Yeah, I think it would. And I also think when you run a business, and especially when you start bringing in people to work for you, I think if you can have conversations that are difficult with your employees and with your team, not only is that going to pay back dividends in their well-being, but it will pay back in dividends in your financial situation as well. This has been proven when humans connect on level that's deeper than the superficiality. We want to work harder. We feel connected to what we do. We want to go the extra mile. And I think once big business starts to see that, like they've saw the headlines in vegan food, once they see that, once you crack well-being and have these conversations, that they'll get on the bandwagon as well, but we'll just get there first.
Yeah, and I think it is these larger companies which will need to be seen to do this, because so many companies at the moment talk about the mental health of their employees being so important, but when that deadline rolls round, you know, all that tends to go out of the window, doesn't it? The extra hours come in, the crunch goes in.
Yeah, and I think that's where, if you've got that ability to have an honest conversation and you've got that relationship with the business that you work for or the leader that you're following, you can bring that up at the time. And if they're just not doing tick box exercises, they'll value your mental health and your well-being. And that's the true test of, is it just tick box or do they actually care about people and mental health?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so just as a final question then that anyone can jump in on, where does our veganism come in on this? You know, we've talked about it a lot. Is it because that we're all vegans and we've all got vegan businesses? Does that mean that we do just connect to each other, you know, more, and we can talk about these things? Is it because we're operating in a safe space, you know, and we can be all honest and more supporting with each other just because we're all on the same mission and we've got the same ethics?
Yeah, I would say that I can't think of too many other sectors which have such a great shared value, ethics and purpose as well. I mean, there probably are some that perhaps operate in charity sectors or in environmental or sustainability, you know, perhaps they would be the, but if you think of a sector, you know, such as IT or legal service or financial services, they don't have the overarching purpose that's driving most, not all, but most vegan businesses, most plant-based businesses have a greater calling, don't they? A greater purpose behind them. I think the difficulty is, and I've always said this, is that it's a bit like turning vegan, but not thinking about, you know, how healthy your diet should be. It's not sustainable. You know, there's no point in, to my mind, in being vegan just for the animals if you eat a rubbish diet, because you're not doing anyone a favor, yourself or the movement, because you won't be able to keep it up. And it'll be another example of someone who's been vegan for a few months and then failed. And I think the same applies to a certain extent to vegan businesses, that it's really important that vegan businesses stand along any other sort of business. And we have the same attitude towards sustainability and profit. Even if that profit isn't distributed in any way, you can be it needs to be sustainable, even if you're social cooperative or a community interest company or whatever, it still needs to be sustainable. So it's not necessarily about profit, it's about sustainability. And if we have an awful lot of vegan businesses which set up and aren't sustainable, then I think, you know, that is something that is concerning. So I think hence it's really important that we do help other vegan businesses to be sustainable and to be realistic and to have good business and management ethics.
Absolutely. And I think that's an absolutely brilliant point just to bring us to a close on, because I am sorry to say that we are now out of time. And I think we could have easily spent an hour with each of our guests today. So I just want to say thank you so much for your time today. And not just our three vegan business experts, but everyone who's watching or listening to this, either live or replay on the Vegan Business Tribe podcast, which I'm sure I'll be putting it out on. But just to give ourselves a little plug as well, if you do have a vegan business or you're thinking about starting one, then Vegan Business Tribe is here to support you and also inspire you, not just to have a vegan business, but to have a successful vegan business as well, whatever your definition of success is. Mm-hmm. And you can find lots more great content just like this on our website at veganbusinesstribe.com or on the weekly podcast as well. You can also join, as Tim mentioned at the start, our paid monthly membership, and that gets you access to all our online networking events, our workshops, our forums, even our vegan marketing course, and just to meet all these other like-minded business entrepreneurs and vegan business owners who are on the same mission as you. So as a thank you, and as a reminder as well of who our three guests were today, we were joined by Mike Hill of One Planet Pizza. And make sure you do go out and check out their cheeseburger pizza, which they've made in partnership with Meatless Farm and Applewood Cheese. It is amazing. We also spoke to Blue O'Connor of King's Grooming and Talk Club. And again, you can buy the King's aftershave from there and their clothing as well online. And you can also pick up a case of Clearhead alcohol-free beer online, which Blue is involved with from Bristol Beer Factory website. And finally, also Lisa Fox from Vegan Business Tribe. And you can also join Lisa on a Make It Happen goal setting and accountability workshop every month over on the Vegan Business Tribe website. Well, I really hope you listened to that one right to the end, even if you did it over a couple of sessions. Now, of course you did listen right to the end, otherwise you wouldn't be listening to me now, I know that. But we covered such important business topics then that are just not spoken about enough. And like I said, I could easily have spent an hour talking to each panelist. So next week, we should be back to our normal running time. But if we've learned anything today, it's about how important it is to have support from people who understand why you are doing what you are doing. So I would love to see you over on the website so you can get involved with our full Vegan Business Tribe community to support you too. And as always, if you can just, before you go, tap the subscribe button or leave us a 5-star review if your platform allows you to do that, or even share this podcast with other people who you think would benefit from the information and the support. If you do any of these things, I will be forever in your debt. So thank you so much for your time. I always hugely appreciate you taking the time out of your, what I know is a very busy week, to listen. And I will see you on the next one.